My name's Butch Maz and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity and privilege of being here and taking part in the conference this weekend. I don't say that because it sounds nice or I need you to like me. I'm saying it because I mean it from the very bottom of my heart. I'm a guy who considers it a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a guy who considers it a privilege to come here and be with you. We could really, and you might hope by the end of this we had, hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer and end this meeting now and go have some fellowship, because really in the last 15 minutes we have witnessed the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We've witnessed what happens when people come here and start to apply spiritual principles to their life. And we've watched it from 1 year up to 55 years. And I sit here and I watch this tonight. And I think that the lives that have been touched by this convention, the lives that people have come here and their lives have changed by being here, the lives that have changed by people making commitments and at jobs and committees and that over 41 years, all because a few people took an action. Incredible power. Empower in these things. Please don't misunderstand what I'm about to say. I know you will, but I'm going to say it anyway. I'm a believer in our book. I am a believer in our process, in our 12 steps. But I sometimes think that we can forget the power in fellowship. Great power in fellowship. I have watched people come to things like this. I've sat beside people in things like this. They've listened to the story of an alcoholic and their lives change and they leave different people. Incredibly powerful. I come to these things and my life will be different at the end of this weekend than before I came here. Great power in the fellowship. And I love coming to these things. I just love it. I've come, we did the countdown. My sponsor, I'm attracted to longevity. Long-time conventions, long-time members. I'm attracted to that. My sponsor was an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. He came to Alcoholics Anonymous on July the 17th, 1958. And he was an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous till the day he died on June the 10th, 2004. And one of the great joys of my AA life, and there's been many, is I traveled. He was, and I say active, I mean active. He went places. And he took me everywhere. I met Bob and Linda with my sponsor over 20 years ago. Number of the people in the room. I met Clancy with my sponsor many years ago. It was one of the great joys of my life of traveling with him. And after I was sober for a little while and would get asked to come up to the front of one of these rooms, he knew how nervous I'd get before coming up here. He'd sit beside me in that meeting before my name was called and he'd rub my back. Aww. They cry at Al-Anon when you do that. And he'd rub my back and he'd say to me, I know it doesn't feel like it, kid, but I'm with you every step of the way. And I'd get up to the front of one of these rooms and look out and there he'd be sound asleep in his chair. And we'd drive home and he'd say, oh, that was a nice talk, Butch. Thanks, Father. It is good. I am touched to be here. So many people, I look at this front row and I'll tell you something, heroes of mine. People, when I was brand new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've always been a guy who's loved listening to the story of an alcoholic. I'd listen to those tapes and that, and many of them here in this room tonight, and I get to come here and be part of this thing. Touches my heart very, very deeply, I'll tell you. It sure does. My home group is the Three Legacy Group, Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Mondays and Thursdays. If you're ever in our part of the country, we'd love to see you there. We have a closed discussion meeting for alcoholics on Mondays. We have an open speaker meeting on Thursdays. I'm a group guy. I believe in the home group. I'm a guy that believes that the home group is the heartbeat of AA. That isn't just podium talk. I truly, truly believe that. I hear people talk about problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. I suppose we do have problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I don't believe there's a single problem in Alcoholics Anonymous that isn't attributed to weak home groups and weak sponsorship. And I equally believe that there isn't a problem that we have that we can't solve with strong home groups and strong sponsorship. I believe that with all my heart. I belong to a group where all three legacies are in place, where it's not just about personal recovery, but where unity's there, where we operate under the umbrella of the traditions and the concepts, where we don't, one or two individuals don't do everything, but as we function together as a group, where we go to detoxes, we put on meetings. I belong to a group where there's enthusiasm. I believe that enthusiasm is contagious. I believe there's nothing more helpful to new people when they come into a room where there's excitement in that room. I love coming into this room where there's that buzz in the room. Don't you? Huh, Beth? I just love that. You know that hum, that chatter? Oh, just like being in a bar. It's like being in a bar. Everybody talking, nobody listening. Beautiful. Alcoholics. Huh? And I love that. So I believe that. I believe I belong to a home group. When you come through that door, there'll be half a dozen people to shake your hand and welcome you. Because I believe that's one of the most important things we can do in Alcoholics Anonymous in a home group. I believe when that new guy or new gal walk through that meeting for their first time, an in-depth version of step four doesn't mean much to them. But a warm handshake, a welcome, come on in and get a coffee and sit here with us, means a great, great deal. So I belong to a strong home group. And I believe that when a guy or gal brand new come into an environment such as that, their chances of recovery become much greater than if they come into something where none of that's in place. I got to go to the thing with Clance a couple weeks ago that the Pacific Group put on. Just incredible power in that fellowship, and that's there. So it is just great to be here and be a part of this, and I thank you. I got to remember where we start. When I say that I'm happy to be here, I really and truly am happy to be here, Chrissy, that's for sure. Because alcoholics don't always get where they're going. Drinking alcoholics seldom get where they're going. But sometimes even sober alcoholics don't get where they're going. I'm going to tell you a quick story about that. Let me first of all tell you there's a time in my life I was not allowed in the United States of America. Let me add, nor should I have been. They said, we have enough people like you here already. We don't need to import them. But I applied to the United States Department of Justice for a waiver. It would allow me to come into your great country. I have it. It's upstairs in my room right now. Beautiful piece of paper about that big. United States Department of Justice has my name on it. Allows me to come into the USA on humanitarian grounds. I don't even know what that means. And every time I come here, including this morning, I have to show them that, and we have a little discussion, sometimes longer than others. The other thing is that when I come here, they want to know where I'm going. They just don't want to know I'm going to Minneapolis. They want to know precisely the address where I'm going. I don't know why they want to know, but they seem to want to know. The other thing is, I don't know about any of you guys, but I from time to time can misplace things. So when I got that waiver, I made 25 photocopies. Just to be safe. So anyway, I'm coming to a thing in Illinois a number of years ago, and I get up early. I like to fly and get here early. I come here to be a part of the convention. I don't come here to talk. I come here to be a part. And anyway, I'm getting all my gear together. I said to my wife, I said, where's my waiver? Like, it's her job to know where my waiver is. She said, I don't know, Butch. It's wherever you've put it. I said, no, it's not. You've lost it. She said, take one of those photocopies and get going. You're going to miss your flight. I got that photocopy. I got all my gear. I headed to Pearson International Airport. Please don't misunderstand what I'm about to say. Our border patrol, our custom agents, Homeland Security do a wonderful job protecting our borders. God bless those men and women. But I think when they go to border patrol school, they teach them how not to smile. Serious people. So anyway, I get there, I get in the line, I give all the guy my stuff, I give him my waiver, he looks at it, he says, what are you, a criminal? I said, well, perhaps you might have said that at one time. He said to me, he says, this is a photocopy. I said, yes, sir, the original's at home for safekeeping. Lies just fall out of my mouth. Just fall. I didn't need to think about that. Just comes natural. I need to think about truth. Lies, natural, rapid fire. He says to me, this is a photocopy. You can't travel on a photocopy. He says, you have your I-94 form? I pulled out a form. He says, that's the wrong form. I thought, this isn't shaping up well. So he said, you go over there, you fill out the proper form, you got to go see somebody about this photocopy because you cannot travel on a photocopy. I thought, I'm not going to Illinois today. But I go over and I fill out the right form, and I've got one of those keen alcoholic minds that you only hear about from alcoholics. You will not hear about the keen alcoholic mind at the Al-Anon meeting tomorrow. I'll tell you that much right now. And I watch and I wait till his line's full and I find a more gentle man like Clancy. And I go to his line. So I go there, I give the guy all my stuff. He's looking at it. He said to me, he says, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Illinois. He says, what's your purpose of business? I said, I'm going to talk at a convention, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said to me, what address are you staying at? Oh, Jesus. I'd forgot to get the address. And I said to him, I said, I don't know. He said to me, you don't know where you're going? I said, no, I don't. I said, but it's okay because somebody's going to pick me up at the airport and take me there. He says to me, who's picking you up at the airport? I said, I don't know. He said, let me get this straight. Somebody you don't know is picking you up, taking you somewhere you don't know where you're going. I said, yes, sir, that's correct. He says to me, what are you going to talk about? And before I can answer him, he holds up his hands and says, hold it, let me guess. You don't know. So I'm happy to be here tonight. I was 25 years old, and my wife had thrown me out of our home. And I want to tell you that I loved her as much as I was capable of loving. It is important that I tell you that, as much as I was capable of loving. I had a new address every night. I lived in the stairwells of apartment buildings on Eglinton Avenue in downtown Toronto. I just went from building to building. I had a new address each night. And at nighttime, I was under that stairwell. In the daytime, I was like a rat in a sewer. Out on the streets looking to score, looking to scam, looking to rip somebody off to get the money I needed to get to do what I need to do. I hear people in AA talk about AA luggage, matching green garbage bags. I didn't have any AA luggage. Had the clothes on my back. Still had an ultra suede jacket, though. Going to be cool at any expense. I'm 25 years old. I'm living in stairwells. I got the clothes on my back, and nobody wants anything more to do with me. And let me add right now, nor should they. Nor should they. Because people like me are users. I use everybody I come in contact with. Now, it doesn't always appear that way, because I want everybody to like me. I'm the guy in the bar buying the drinks for everybody, passing the bag of powder around, everybody's friend, good old Butch. The only reason I ever did anything for anyone was so that you'd like me. So I'll tell you who I use most is the people who love me, the people who care the most, because they can't stop trying. They keep trying one more time. This time it's going to work. This time it's going to happen. And they keep giving and giving, and I keep taking and taking, till eventually I break their hearts. And the people who love me most got to push me aside because they can't stand to watch it any longer. And that's where I am, 25 years old. I'm in the East End of Toronto one night, all jacked up and nowhere to go, as I said. And my wife and I owned a home in the Beaches down near the lakefront. And we had a screened-in porch and a couple wicker couches on it. And I thought, I'm going to slip in there and get a couple hours and get out before she wakes up. Well, I pass out. And I wake up to one of these. And I opened my eyes and looked, and there was that little gal that I loved. And she looked at me with disgust and pity. And she said, Butch, you're a useless piece of scum, and you will never change. And if you cared anything about me at all, you'd get up and get out of here, and please don't ever come back, because I can't stomach to look at you. And I got up and I left there, and it was July or August, I don't know, but it was a hot, hot summer day, and I'm hungover, and I'm sick, and I'm dirty, and I'm heartsick. And I walked down to what they call the boardwalk, down on the lakefront. And I'm sitting down there in that condition on a park bench, and over where Bob and Linda are sitting, there was another bench. And there was a little boy, 5 or 6 years old, sitting there eating a popsicle. And I looked over at that little boy, and you know what I thought to myself? Wish I had a dime for a popsicle. The big shot. The guy in the bar buying everybody drinks. The dope dealer. Everybody's friend, good old Butch, sitting on a park bench wishing he had a dime for a popsicle. And guys, here was the thought that I had at that moment, as clear as I'm thinking tonight. I knew at that moment that that park bench and places like it was where I was going to go back to every single time. I've always been a talker and a hustler. I knew I'd put a deal together. I'd come up with some cash. I always did. But I knew at that moment that that park bench and places like it was where I was going to end back up every time, and I knew it beyond a shadow of a doubt. I was 25 years old. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 33. I had 8 more years on those streets. And I will not bore you tonight with a horror story because I don't believe it would serve any purpose. You see, if you're an alcoholic like me, you already know it never gets better. It always gets worse. And I had 8 more years on those streets. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 33, and I joined that group. And I got a sponsor. And I did the things you guys told me to do. Forget that suggested crap, the stuff you told me to do. Huh? You know where I was a handful of years ago? Huh? I was in Rome, Italy. Ho-ho! Rome, Italy. Standing in the Sistine Chapel, looking at the paintings of Michelangelo from hundreds of years before, my wife standing beside me, and the tears started to roll down my cheeks. And I thought of that guy sitting on that park bench wishing he had a dime for a popsicle. Long way from that park bench to the Sistine Chapel in Rome. It is a long way from where you and I came from. Many of us here tonight, the dregs of society. Many of us here tonight, our own families didn't even want anything more to do with us. Yet here we sit this weekend in Minneapolis, men and women living good, rich, full, productive lives, members of Alcoholics and Al-Anon. How do we get from where we were to where we sit tonight? How does that happen? Because it's not supposed to happen for people like you and I. But you know how it happens, don't you? And it only happens one way, and that is through the grace of God. Through a loving God that you introduced me to through a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps Alcoholics Anonymous. I started to drink at an early age. I hear people talk about dysfunctional families. Was my family dysfunctional? I don't know. Let me just tell you, it wasn't the Cleaver residence at my home. There was lots of parties in my home. Always on the weekend, there was a party. They'd let me play bartender as a little boy. I could take them beers and take away the empties. They'd let me have swigs, and they'd say, "Isn't he cute?" And I loved that attention. So I started to drink when I was 4 years old. Now, I wasn't a daily drinker when I was 4. My allowance wouldn't allow it. I actively sought out alcohol. I was 12 or 13 years old. I got a guy to go into a liquor store, get us a couple bottles of wine. I was going to be a wine connoisseur. 2 bottles of Old Sailor. I think that's comparable to what you call Thunderbird in your country. And I'll tell you, any wine I ever drank had a cap, not a cork. We drank that wine, got drunk, puked, and passed out, and that was the end of my social drinking. All downhill from there. I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous at home. I don't know if you have this here, Clance. I'm sure you do in the States. I hear at some of these topic discussion meetings, people say that they came to Alcoholics Anonymous hoping Alcoholics Anonymous was going to teach them how to be a social drinker. Came to Alcoholics Anonymous hoping Alcoholics Anonymous is going to help them become a social drinker. I want to tell you tonight, I didn't want to be a social drinker when I drank. I don't want to be a social drinker tonight. I don't particularly like social drinkers. I find them weird. Weird. You ever drink with a soda? You watch a soda, they let the ice melt in their glass. Sick. Sick. You ever drink with a social drink? It's enough to make you puke, isn't it? My beautiful wife's a social drinker, right? Eh? Bob and Chrissy know my wife good, the most beautiful little girl. She's at home praying for me right now. But my wife is a social drinker. And a little while ago, I was at home. We have an open concept thing in our home, and I'm sitting in the living room. I looked over in the kitchen, and there was Dee in the kitchen, and she had a bottle of wine on the kitchen counter with a funnel in it. I thought, what's she doing with that funnel? So I watched her. Then she takes a glass of wine and starts pouring it in the funnel. I said to her, "What are you doing?" She says to me, I put too much in the glass. I said, don't you ever do that again. I'll divorce you. Social drinker. I'm a barroom drinker. I don't identify with closet alcoholics. Doesn't mean they're not alcoholic. Just drank differently than me. You know, you hear those people, they get the bottle, go in and lock the door, put on the country western music. I don't identify. Barroom drinker. I love bars. I like opening the door to a bar. The smoke it billow out, the tinkle of glass, the smell of stale urine. I love it. I love it. I like neon. I like neon. I like neon when I was drinking. I still like neon. That's why I stay out of casinos. They're not good for guys like me. And I got to tell you, I thank God I never tried to get sober in the United States of America. I don't know if I'd have made it. God, I love to drink in your country. I love drinking. You got many more than we have in Canada. I call them juke joints. You know those divey, scuzzy little rat hole bars, huh? You've got some here. We passed some on the way. Beautiful. Oh, beautiful. I get a fuzzy feeling when I see them. Anyway, I love those things. You know, they got that neon sign that says cocktails. Oh. I went to an AA thing a number of years ago in Pennsylvania. My wife came with me. I decided to drive. I'm driving through this little town in the middle of nowhere. I'm driving down the main street. I hammer on the brakes to my car. I'm back in my car up. My wife said to me, Butch, what are you doing? I said, I got to see this again. And guys, I'm telling you, there it was, Clarence, there it was. This divey, scuzzy little rat hole bar had a neon sign. Said, stop for one, stay till one. Ho! Oh. Oh. Ho! If I'd have been drinking, I'd have had that tattooed on me. It's a work of art. Anyway, I loved all that stuff. I'm not going to talk any more about my drinking tonight, other than to quickly share with you what drinking does for an alcoholic of my type. The things that I'm going to share with you, I did not know at the time. I did not know this when it was happening. I saw it in inventory. I saw it as you took me back through my life and helped me see my life honestly for the very first time. But as I look back today, I remember being a young boy in school. I'd be in that classroom. I'd be 10 years old, 11 years old, I don't know. And there'd be a teacher at the front of the room, and she'd ask a question, and she'd start looking around that room to see who she's going to ask to answer that question. And my head would go down like this. Oh, Jesus, don't let her ask me. Because I knew if she made eye contact with me, she's asking me to answer the question, and I don't want to answer the question. It doesn't even matter if I know the answer to the question, I don't want to answer the question. When I went to school, we used to have to do book report. Get up in front of the whole classroom full of kids. Oh, no good. No good. I get up in the morning, I'd say, Ma, I've been puking all night. I'm sick. I can't go to school today, Ma. Please don't make me go. Because I want to tell you that I would be absolutely terrified at the thought of getting up in front of that classroom full of kids. Terrified. Every decision I ever made in my life was based on fear. Most of it unfounded and ungrounded, but fear. Where I go, what I do, who I hang out with is all based on a comfort level. I don't know about any of you guys, but I every now and then would get goofy. I'd go on about a 5-day bender. I'd come home on a Sunday after being gone for 5 days. My wife would be waiting there for me. I'd come in that house, I'd say, sweetheart, that's it. No more. No more, never. I know I said it before, but honey, this time I swear my ma's life, I'm never having another drink of whiskey. I promise you. That's Sunday. I'd wake up Monday. I'd think to myself, I shouldn't have said that. I'd have to go to a wedding that following Saturday. You ever go to a wedding sober? That's a bad deal. That is a bad, bad deal. I would be at that church sweating, thinking about that reception that's going to start in 3 hours. I'm back at that reception and the dance is going to start and I don't have anything in me and my hands are sweaty. I got a knot in the pit of my gut. I feel awkward and out of place and it is just horrible. And I have to do one of two things. I got to get over to that bar and get a couple drinks into me, or I got to get out of there because I can't stand the way I feel. Every decision I make is based on that fear. You want to know what kills an alcoholic like me? I don't even know I'm afraid. I think I'm afraid of nothing, and I'm afraid of everything, and I don't even know it. We talk an awful lot at some of these topic meetings. Let's discuss resentments. I prefer to call it hate. Hate. I know you're not that sick in Minneapolis, but hate. I'm the type of alcoholic, I'm out driving in my car, I'm at a red light, and I'm on the nod by now. That light would turn green, and the guy behind me would lay on his horn. Whoa. I almost go through the roof of my car. I want to get out of my car, go back there, open his door, drag him out by the throat, take a crowbar, and crash his skull open. I know some of you spiritual giants never thought thoughts like that. Sure. But I do. I'm not talking anger management here. No, I'm talking rage. I'm talking a white rage. I'm talking the kind of rage that I don't have 10 minutes before and I don't have 10 minutes after. But I have a rage inside of me that comes out every now and then, and I can't control it. And I say things or do things to people I never wanted to say or do. And let me tell you who takes the brunt of my rage. You see, when you're a guy who's constantly seeking everybody's approval, when you're out there trying to impress and make everyone like you, you don't display that anger there. You keep it for behind closed doors. You see, it's the people who love me and care about me that take the brunt of my rage. Lonely. I'm 25 years old, I'm standing at a subway platform in downtown Toronto on a Friday night all jacked up, and a train pulled up and the doors opened, and a young couple my age got off that train holding hands, and they walked off into the night laughing and smiling. And I saw that couple, and God, I felt sad. I thought, why can't I be like those people? Why is all the trouble got to keep happening in my life? I remember walking through a nice residential area on a warm summer's night. You get that nice warm August night and it's just getting dark, a warm breeze, and I'd walk down a street and I'd see the nice homes. And I'd see the television on inside and the families in there. And I feel like crying. Why can't I just have a nice home and a family like other people? Why has all this crap got to keep happening in my life time and time again? From as long as I can ever remember, I was restless, irritable, and discontented. If I was drinking at this bar, I'd say, drink up, let's go over to that bar. If we're at this party, I'd say, guys, let's drink up, go down to that party. If I was married to you, I should be married to her. Never quite right. And I don't know about you guys, but I tell you, I get one of those double vodkas. Whatever I was doing that day, it was just like this. Here, I don't know if you remember or not. I'll give you one more. Here. I did that in a meeting one night. Two guys get up and left. You should see when I do that at detox. They're on the ceiling. It's beautiful. Beautiful. I have a few of those double vodkas, and let me tell you something. I walk into that wedding now like I own the joint. Huh? And I am moving and grooving. And I'm talking to the ladies, and I'm sitting with my buddies, and we're drinking and snorting and carrying on. And at that moment, everything in my life is absolutely perfect. And my perception of reality changes. Same hall, same wedding, same people, same music, same everything. But you put four vodkas in me, and that whole room looks different. And I get an immediate sense of ease and comfort. And that is why I drink whiskey. Because I like the effects produced by it. But I am alcoholic. Something happens to me when I drink whiskey that doesn't happen ever to the average temperate drinker, called a phenomenon of craving. And I'd start drinking and I couldn't seem to stop. I'd drink 60 ounces of vodka and I'd end up smashing up my car. I'd go out after work for a few beers with my buddies. I'd go on a 5-day bender. I'm getting fired from my job. I tell my wife I'm going out for a loaf of bread. I run into Bob. I come home 3 months later. My wife's leaving. I'm out there drinking, partying, carrying on. I don't want to stop. I got no money, so I'm stealing yours. And now I go to jail. And what everybody focused on in my life was the crash cars, the broken marriages, lost jobs, going to jail. We looked at drinking. We never looked at alcoholism. And people told me from the time I was 18 years old, if I just quit drinking whiskey and sticking needles in my arms, I'd be all right. And there was times I wasn't drinking whiskey, and guess what? I wasn't all right. As a matter of fact, I'm crazier sober than I ever was when I drank. But all those well-meaning people could see, and they were well-meaning, was that when I drank, the trouble that followed. So naturally, they said, stop drinking. But those well-meaning people didn't understand how I feel when I'm sober. How could they know? I didn't even know. I would love to stand up here at night and tell you, I woke up one morning, HFC was dying to lend me money. Work was thinking of promoting me, and my wife was sending me flowers. And I thought, I think I'll join AA today. Huh? Every now and then I hear some moron from the front of one of these rooms say things like, if you're not here for the right reasons, you might as well drink. And every now and then I'd like to get that tire iron back out. The right reasons? Did you come to Alcoholics Anonymous for the right reasons? Jesus. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I had nowhere else to go. One more time, my back was against the wall. My boss called me into work on a Tuesday. He said, Butch, you're a hard worker. I said, well, thank you. He said, but you're not here much. Picky, picky. He said, you think you might have a problem with alcohol? I said, no, but I know what the problem is. He said, maybe you'd share that with me. I said, it's my health. He said, really? I said, yes. Now, granted, my poor health may have something to do with my drinking. I'm going to quit drinking. My health's going to get better. Everyone's going to be okay. He said, you think you might need some help quitting drinking? I said, no, I'm just going to quit. Got up and left his office. As to find out later, his wife had been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years. Can you imagine the chuckle he had as I left, Bruce? Huh? Oh, he's just going to quit. That was Tuesday. I woke up Thursday in another hotel room in another town drunk. I didn't keep him waiting long. And for whatever the reason, that morning I woke up, I knew the jig was up. I knew I had used all the lies. Huh? Alcoholics are liars. I don't know what that's about. I would lie when the truth would serve me better. Pathological liar. I am the type of alcoholic that goes out and plays golf all by himself and cheats on the scorecard. I do. That's not the best part. At the end, I look at the card and go, good game, Butch, good game. So I'd used all the lies. I know I'm in trouble. I got to come up with something good. So I had a few tequilas. I turned my mind to it. I thought, I know what I'll tell them. I'm alcoholic and I'm going to go to AA. And that's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if there's anybody here tonight who's new, and I know there is, we couldn't care less why you're here. We couldn't care less. We're just glad to see you. We're just glad to see you. And maybe, maybe, by the grace of God, someone will say something, you'll hear something, you'll read, and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon can happen in your life, and you can go on to live a happy and useful life like so many men and women have been able to do. Just keep coming. Just keep coming. And as I said in the beginning, I've been an absolutely blessed man since the day I came here. On September the 21st, 1989, two men came to my mother's house practicing Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. That should tell you something right there, my mother's house. Somewhere every 33-year-old self-respecting alcoholic should be is with mummy. Two men came to my mother's house practicing Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form, its purest form. They left their homes, they took time out of their lives, they came to my mother's house and talked to me about their drinking. They did not talk to me about my drinking. They did not tell me I shouldn't drink, I shouldn't drug, I should go to they didn't tell me nothing. Those two men came to my mother's house, talked to me about their drinking, and told me what had happened in their lives since they came to something called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would I like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with them? Huh? I'd been running the streets since I was 13 years old. I was a helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic. And those two men left their homes, came, and took me to that meeting that first night, September the 21st, 1989. I've been with you ever since that night. Incredibly blessed. Incredibly blessed. Deep, deep love in my heart for the old timers. Deep, deep love. Men and women that have been coming for 20 and 30 and 40 and 55 years, who made sacrifices and commitments to Alcoholics Anonymous so it would be here for people like Beth and I. I love them from the very bottom of my heart. And if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would urge you to get close to these men and women and learn from their experience, because we won't have them with us forever. And I had some giants come into my life. I've heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous say you should never put people on pedestals. Well, you do what you need to do. But let me tell you something. I have some people on pedestals. Many of them right here in this room tonight. Right here in this room. Never for a moment have I lost sight of their humanities. You want to know the greatest gift my sponsor, Bobby Dobson, ever gave me? Clance knew my sponsor. The greatest gift he ever gave me. It wasn't some brilliant spiritual thing he laid on me, some divine wisdom he pulled out of the book. The greatest gift my sponsor ever gave me was he allowed me to see his warts. He allowed me to see him get afraid. He allowed me to see him get angry. He allowed me to see him get selfish. He allowed me to see him get lustful. He allowed me to see all of him. Because if he hadn't, and you don't continue to, I will never measure up. We are much more brothers and sisters in our defects than we are in our virtues, aren't we? And I had some wonderful people, none more than my own sponsor. I've heard people say, if you like your sponsor, you have the wrong sponsor. I hear that and I know I'm listening to an idiot. Idiot. Didn't like my sponsor. I loved him and I love my sponsor today. You see, you were the very first people who helped me understand what my problem was. I don't know about any of you, but when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue I'd been told what my problem was. A lot of people told me, my wife told me what my problem was. The judges told me what my problem was. Psychiatrists told me. All kinds of people have been telling me for years, just quit drinking. You were the first people that said drinking's not your problem. It's your solution. How you feel when you're sober is your problem. You are restless, irritable, and discontent, and you have to drink again. You see, I don't have a choice whether I drink or not. I have lost the power and choice. That is the difference between me and the hard drinker. That is what makes me alcoholic. I have to drink again. An alcoholic of my type not drinking and not treating alcoholism and sitting in AA meetings does not treat alcoholism. That is the great myth that kills many, many alcoholics. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous treat alcoholism. The meetings are where the solution is. The meetings are where the fellowship is. But the 12 steps treat my illness. I didn't have a clue. So an alcoholic of my type, not drinking and not treating alcoholism, will eventually, and that's the key word, eventually, will get so restless, irritable, and discontent sober that I have to do one of two things. I don't have a choice. I have to do one or the other. Either drink again or blow my brains out. Most of us drink again. But we all know someone who's paid the supreme sacrifice, don't we? Didn't have a clue. You told me that selfishness and self-centeredness was the root of my trouble. I didn't come to AA and do an inventory and go, my, Butch, you haven't been a very nice boy. I didn't need an inventory to know I was lying, cheating, thief. But I had absolutely no idea of the depth of my self-centeredness and how it came into my life. Didn't have a clue. If you'd have asked me the day I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, Butch, what kind of a guy are you? You know what I'd have said to you? I'm a good guy. I'm a fine man. And you could have hooked me up to a lie detector test and asked me that question, and that needle would not budge. Because I believe that. Let me tell you why I believe that. You see, I always judged myself by my intentions. My intentions were always good. Unfortunately, the world judges us by our actions. And my actions and intentions never lined up. Selfishness and self-centered, the root of my troubles. And from that self-centeredness comes 100 forms of fear and all my resentments, but all based in self. And you told me that I had to be rid of this selfishness or else it would kill me. And there seemed no way of getting rid of it without God's help. And you told me that is what the purpose of our steps were. That was the purpose of our program. A series of actions that I take, I start to apply spiritual principles to my life and allow me to find a power greater than myself that will solve my problem. Didn't have a clue. I thank God for the foundation you gave me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so terribly, terribly grateful that it has served me well all this time up until including tonight. You taught me what it meant to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know our traditions and I believe in our traditions say you're a member when you say you're a member. I don't disagree, but that's not the case for me. Saying I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous means more than saying I'm a member. You taught me what it meant to be a member of a home group, to not just run around from meeting to meeting sucking everything I could out of it, but being an active participating member in a group. You encouraged me to start to read and understand our traditions, to become an informed member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So at my business meetings, I didn't just put my hand up because Bob puts his hand up. An informed member. You encouraged me to understand our traditions. Our traditions are as much a part of my life and as much a deflator of ego as our steps ever have been. You encouraged me to read about our history. AA comes of age, Dr. Bob and the good old timers, pass it on. You said, if you're going to spend your life in Alcoholics Anonymous, would you not like to know where you came from? Would you not like to know what was done on your behalf so we could sit here at Gopher State and enjoy this beautiful weekend? And you gave me that foundation. You told me that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action. A program action. It's about doing. It's about change. And the changes start small and they start to grow. You told me to go to my home group and any other meeting early. Go to the washroom, get your coffee, sit down and be quiet. Maybe you don't want to listen to what's going on in that meeting, Butch, but maybe those gentlemen sitting there would like to. And for once in your life, why don't you think of someone else other than yourself? Oh, was true. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sewer for a mouth. I didn't know any other way to talk. I've been running those streets since I was 13. And nobody embarrassed me in an AA meeting. Nobody centered me out or humiliated me. But you took me aside after the meeting with love and kindness. And you said, kid, this isn't some juke joint bar room you're sitting in now. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a classy organization of ladies and gentlemen. And we don't use that filthy language in AA, Butch. Maybe it doesn't bother you, but maybe it bothers that gentleman sitting there, and for once in your life, think of someone else. Oh, it was true. And the changes started small, and they started to grow. And you took me through this process. Thank God for strong sponsorship. Thank God I didn't hear some of this quick-lip crap that I hear in AA. Oh, just don't drink and go to the meetings. You'll be okay. Isn't that a nice little out for me so that I could sit at home on a Friday night and watch my flat-screen TV? Huh? No, the people who came into my life said, you have a lot more wrong with you than drinking, kid. You come with us and we're going to show you what's wrong. And more importantly, we're going to show you what you got to do to get well. And you took me through this process. I think one of the greatest disservices we do is give new people a big book and say, here, go do this. Huh? Because see, I suffer from a disease of perception. I at times cannot differentiate the truth from the false. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure you'll be happy to do so. But I think it says in step 10 that by now sanity will have returned, which infers that I've been operating from an insane position up till then. I need your guidance. I need you to take me through this process to help me see what I can't see. Because you see, it's an incredible thing. I sponsor a lot of guys at home, and I can spot when those guys are getting off track just like that. Just like that. I can hear when they phone. Those little rats, huh? I hear in their voice, lying, I know it in a minute. But it's an incredible thing. I don't see it so clearly in me. It's like there's a thin veil there when it comes me seeing me. Huh? That's why sponsors need sponsors. I need your direction. And so you took me through this process and you took me through the amends, an incredibly freeing process for me. Incredibly freeing. I spent my entire life seeking your approval. My entire life. Where I go, what I do, how I dress, how I talk, all based on seeking approval. Every single person I ever met, I've always sized myself up. When I went to school, they had the kids that did good in school and belonged to the teams and the clubs, huh? I hated those kids' guts, huh? I hated them. I didn't know why then, I know now. I didn't feel as good as those kids. Then they had the kids behind the school were starting to smoke and drink and cutting up. That's where I hung out, because I felt a little sharper than most of those kids. But my entire life, every person I've ever met, all my life, and coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, and today, if I don't stay in fit spiritual condition, the first thing I do when I meet someone is size myself up. And I'm always better than or less than, but never the same as. And I went through that amends process and the rest of this, and I'm able today to just be a member Alcoholics Anonymous. Just one of God's kids, no better than, no less than. And I can look you in the eye and I don't have to look at the floor any longer. A freeing process for a guy that was so much in the bondage of self. So much. Huh? I've listened to people debate in a meeting for 45 minutes whether they were recovered or recovering. Jesus, Murphy. Smoke starts coming out my ears, for God's sakes. Our book is very, very clear about that. But you showed me in the book where it said it is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. And if we do, we're headed for trouble. Because I'm not cured of alcoholism. Not cured of alcoholism. Huh? I know you, I'm going to tell you something. The longer I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know you'd never do that here. But the longer I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes the harder it is for me to be truthful with you. Sometimes the longer I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, the harder it is for me to come to you and tell you I'm dying inside and I don't know what to do. Because I've been an active member of AA for a long time now and I want you to think I have it all together. Sometimes the longer I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, the easier it is for me to become critical and judgmental. I know you wouldn't do that in Minneapolis, but in Toronto. Huh? Easy to let up on the spiritual program of action, huh? And rest on our laurels. You see, I cannot stay in fit spiritual condition today because I used to be an inner group rep. I cannot stay in fit spiritual condition because I used to be a GSR. I cannot stay in fit spiritual condition because I used to make coffee at my home group. I cannot stay in fit spiritual condition because I used to work with a lot of new people. I stay in fit spiritual condition by the actions that I take today, not by what I used to do. And it is easy to let up in that program of action. And the insidiousness of alcoholism. There's a line that the longer I'm sober, Bob, becomes more and more true to me all the time about this illness being cunning, baffling, and powerful. The insidiousness of alcoholism is I can start to drift and never know it. It is so slow and so subtle, and I watch it in guys time and time again. We have a lot of speaker meetings at home. A lot of these boys been in our area a lot of times over all these years talking. We have a lot of speaker meetings. And we have a noon meeting at home. I live outside of the city, about 150,000 people in our community. They have a noon meeting every day. I don't get to that meeting. My sponsor insisted I work. But anyway, it's there. It's there. Anyway, I had a guy that he came to me. I didn't know this guy too good. He was maybe in his mid-60s, and he came to me and said, Butch, I'm going to have a one-year birthday. Would you come and talk at my birthday? At home, when you celebrate your birthdays, you can pick the talker and the chair people and stuff and that. And anyway, I said I'd be honored to do that. I went to this noon meeting, and I'm there, and the fellow, they started the meeting, and the chairperson called him up, with his sponsor, gave him his coin, his one-year coin, and the fellow's wife and son and daughter and grandson were sitting in that front row. And the tears poured down this guy's face as he tried to thank the group and Alcoholics Anonymous for everything that had given him. And you and I have watched that thousands of times, haven't we? Thousands of times. And many of those same men and women turn and walk away from here. Why? Why is it that so many people come here and for the very first time in their life find a solution? Why is it that so many people come here for the very first time in their life find a place where they fit and belong, find some happiness and some peace and joy in their life? So many of those people, and then turn around, walk away, and go back to that hell. Why would we ever do that? I believe that it starts the minute I let up on that spiritual program of action. I really and truly do. I am closer to the center of Alcoholics Anonymous than I have ever been in all my years here with you. Because let me tell you something, I have a lot more to lose tonight than I did almost 25 years ago when I walked into this room. You sure want to believe that I want to stay close to you because I need you. I need you. I don't care how long I'm sober. I don't care what I do or have done or ever will do. I need you. Incredible thing. And you told me, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was never a disbeliever. If you'd have asked me the day I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, do you believe in God? I would have said to you, yeah, I believe there's a God. It had as much meaning in my life as the price of coffee beans in Brazil tonight. But I wasn't a disbeliever, not a disbeliever. You know, Chuck used to talk and that. I'd listen to those tapes, and Chuck said that we have one problem and only one problem. And from that one problem comes all other problems. And that one problem is a conscious separation from God. You see, I thought God was way up there in heaven. And he had long hair and a beard and a big stick. Charlton Heston. Charlton Heston. And if you were good, good things happen. And if you were bad, bad things happen. Huh? Well, if God's way up there and I'm down here, have you ever heard more of a conscious separation in your life? Huh? You were the first people that said to me, deep down inside of every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And it seems that it is only there that he may be found. And that the great reality for us is that our Creator has entered our hearts and lives in a way that is indeed miraculous. You've given me that. You've done that for me. Don't you love, we refer to those promises that we talk about all the time. Don't you love it that where it says we will suddenly realize. Suddenly realize, huh? We talk an awful lot about Bill's spiritual experience, the white light experience. We all talk about that in AA. We're all very familiar. Bill was an alcoholic. I have a feeling the more time Bill's told that story, the brighter that light got. Just saying. Just saying. It was as though the room lit up. It was as though the warm wind. I love when he says that the words that he used had to be that we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could never do for ourselves. You know that time? You know that time when sometime you're sitting in a conference, you're sitting in a meeting, and somebody says something and the light goes on. You know that time when you're driving down the road and all of a sudden for that first time your eyes start to fill up with tears and you know. And we suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could never do for ourselves. I think that what happened to Bill happens to exactly all of us. Just in little different ways at different times. And we suddenly know. And I go from believing to knowing. I go from believing to experiencing this power in my life. Incredible thing. And it becomes the main part of my life. Real working power in my life. I found a God through you. That's why we tell our stories. In our own language and from our own point of view. It's in listening to your stories that I came to believe. It was in watching you. It was watching these guys do what they do for 40 and 50 years. It's been watching your actions. Not so much what you said, but what I watch you do. And I came to believe. And the great reality for me today is that my Creator has entered my heart and lives in a way that is indeed miraculous. You've done that for me. You've given me that. And the great paradox, you told me if I want to keep it, I got to give it away. Huh? That nothing ensures us immunity from drinking like intensive work with other alcoholics. When all else fails, this works. The occasional good deed is not enough. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others. Unless I continue to enlarge and perfect my spiritual life through unselfish acts and helping others, I will surely drink when I hit those certain low spots. If you're an Alcoholics Anonymous for a few years now and things are going good and life's never been better, huh, and everything's coming up aces, buckle up. Buckle up. Life will happen. And you better have some power when it does. Huh? Incredible gift. I think we still got about 10 minutes. I'm taking them anyway. And we've been blessed, haven't we? You see it here. Huh? We've been so blessed. Huh, Clarence? A whole lifetime. Good things. A wonderful life. If we hadn't been given enough, then you and I are then given the ability to change people's lives. That's not an ego statement. That is a statement of gratitude. That is a statement of humility. You and I, when armed with facts about ourselves, that's what this process does. That's what these steps are designed to do, to arm me with facts about myself so I then can go out and be a maximum service to God and those about us. That's my purpose here. That's my job here, to be of service, to be help others. And when you and I have those facts and have this solution, are able to make the difference in a few short hours when nobody else was able to. Incredible gift. Until such an understanding is met, very little can happen for the other alcoholic. Incredible gift. It says in our life that alcoholics laugh at sometimes seemingly tragic situations. You ever wondered sometimes what visitors think of us? Huh? You know, somebody's having a birthday, your family met. We just had one last night at our home group. All the family were there, co-workers were there, all that. Some monkey like me gets up here and says things like, yes, I bought a brand new Cadillac. I picked it up at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning and totaled it at 10. Oh, we all laugh. Laugh. Clancy talks about having no teeth and living in the car. We find that just hilarious. I got a buddy from California, Doug, talks about spilling a bottle of whiskey in his bed and then sucking it out of the sheets. You ever wonder what those visitors might be thinking? It says we laugh at sometimes seemingly tragic situations. Know what he says after that? Why shouldn't we? Why shouldn't we? Because we have recovered. We've recovered and been given the power to help others. God's power, not my power. Incredible gift. My life before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous had absolutely no meaning or no purpose. None. I was either drunk, planning on getting drunk, recovering from being drunk. In trouble, trying to get out of trouble, planning on more trouble. I work all week so I can get drunk all weekend. I deal so I can do. That's my life. And all the people in my life are the same. Alkies don't hang out with social drinkers. No meaning, no purpose. I go to a detox at home, not because I'm some saint, some wonderful human being. It's the way I've been taught. I am the product of strong sponsorship, and I believe in strong sponsorship. And I believe that without strong sponsorship, our chances of recovery are almost nil. Almost nil. So anyway, I go there, and I like to go on Sundays if I'm in town. We have a big speaker meeting, 200-300 people. I like to take new people to speaker meetings so they can listen. I happen to think it's good for new people to listen. I know it's not that fashionable today, but I happen to think it's good. Anyway, I go there one Sunday. There's a guy in there, and he's in bad shape. I'm not talking detoxing, hungover. I'm talking physically. I thought, this guy might die. He might not make it. Well, I figured to myself, he could die at the meeting as easy as he can die here. Dying's dying. You got to do it somewhere. So come on. Right? Well, I took him to the meeting. After the meeting, he and I spent an hour together or two talking about this design for living, this practical program of action. And I left him. I never saw him again. I'm sitting in a meeting one day. So you can see some guy coming across the room. I could see he's headed for me. Clean-cut looking guy. Had a shirt, pair of slacks on. Come walking up. He said, Butch, you probably don't remember me. I said, I'm sorry, I can't say that I do, but I meet a lot of people. He says, my name's Ziggy. I went, holy smokes. That's not really what I said, but that's what I'm saying here. He said, you remember me? I said, oh, I remember you. It's the guy. And he's looking good. He said, Butch, I just wanted to come and thank you for taking me to that meeting. It's almost been a year and I haven't had a drink. I said, congratulations. He said, I was wondering if I can ask a favor of you. I said, if I can do it, I will. He said, will you come and talk at my 1 year AA birthday? I said, I'd be honored to do that, Ziggy. I went and talked at a group a handful of years ago. I got to the front of that room, big crowd of people there. I started to cry. I couldn't get rolling. And I'll tell you why. I looked out and there sitting at the front table in a suit and tie, looking like $1 million, with his wife and all his children, was Ziggy. And he was getting his 15-year medallion. Took him to his first meeting, talked at his 1, talked at his 5, talked at his 10, talked at his 15. You think my life doesn't have meaning? You think my life doesn't have purpose? My life is so rich, so full. I could stand up here for the next 2 hours. I'd be all alone, but I could do it. I could do it. I live a life beyond honest to God. I have a wife at home that I just absolutely adore with every fiber of my body. These guys know my wife good. I just love that little gal so much. It's incredible. Let me tell you a quick little story. We've got a few minutes. Two quick stories. I like watching the golf. I like watching the golf on Sundays. I'll watch if I see some. I like it. You like watching the golf too? Anyway, I love watching Sundays, and I love it when the final pairing, the guy is in the lead, you know, when they're walking up that 18th fairway. And I was watching it one time, and it was the Masters, and Phil Mickelson was leading in the final pairing. And his wife was going through cancer treatment. And Phil Mickelson was walking up that 18th fairway with a 3 or 4 stroke lead, doesn't matter, and knew he'd won the Masters. And you flash to him walking up there, and his eyes were full of tears. He was doing everything he could to hold it together. And they'd flash to his wife, and his wife was there, a beautiful woman with their 2 little girls. And you could see the tears in her eyes. And I'm watching this, Linda, and the tears are rolling down my cheeks. And I looked over at my D, and I said, D, I said, can you imagine how proud she must be of him? And my wife didn't miss a beat. She looked at me and said, I know exactly how she feels. Exactly. You've done that for me. Everything in my life that is good is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything. Anything I am or ever hope to be is because of people like you. Because of people like you. I love them. People say to me, but you talk how grateful you are a lot at those meetings. Couldn't help but notice you have a new car out in the parking lot. Business going pretty good. Nice home and a wife. How grateful would you be if things weren't going so well? That's a fair question, isn't it? That sponsor that I talked to you about, I love that man as much as life itself. Bob had emphysema and he was dying. And he'd been in the hospital twice that month, and we were taking him out to some meetings. He was on oxygen all the time, and we'd take him in a wheelchair. And we were to go. He was to talk at a gal's one-year birthday. Her dad was a past delegate, and her mom was strong Al-Anon. And it was June the 8th, and it was a hot, hot, humid day, and the old man was not good. And I called him up. I said, Bob, I'm going to call Cliff and Mary and tell them that we're not going to come to the meeting. It was a couple hours from home. It was one of those low-ceiling halls with no air conditioning. I said, Bob, they wouldn't want you to come in this heat like that. He said, that young lady's expecting us. We'll be there. I said, okay. I went and got him. I had an SUV. I got his wheelchair, oxygen tanks, hoses. I got more stuff than the paramedics got. I get him in that truck. We drive a couple hours to the meeting. There's no wheelchair access. The boys put him right in the chair, carried him down the stairs in the chair, got him to the front of the room, got his hoses and tanks on. Hoses, we plugged him into the wall. Power. And he gave everything that he had. Everything that he had, he gave it. And at the end of that night, he was spent, Bob. He was spent. And the boys got all the gear and stuff, and they got him up into the truck, and he and I were pulling out of the parking lot for the 2-hour drive home, and he looked over at me and said, kid, I'm awfully glad you were with me tonight. I said, well, I'm awfully glad I was with you too, Bob. We were always together. We went everywhere together for 15 years. He said, no, kid, I'm really glad you're with me tonight. He said, I think I just made my last talk. I said, oh, Bob, I said, you're tired. You'll feel better tomorrow. You have to understand that we have a lot of speaker meetings at home. My sponsor talked at somewhere between 100 and 150 AA meetings a year for 45 years. We got the drive home. I got him up into that condo I was going to go. He said, kid, you have a couple minutes? I said, I got all the time in the world. He said, I want to look in my journal. And he went and got his journal and came out. He said, it's okay, kid. You can go home now. He says, there's nothing in the journal. That's the first time that journal had been empty in 45 years. I went home, and that was June the 8th. The next day, June the 9th, I phoned him. He was feeling a little bit better. And on June the 10th, AA's birthday, I called him at supper time, and I didn't get an answer. And I called back a half hour later, and I didn't get an answer. And you know when you know, and you don't want to know. I drove around for 2 hours, because I didn't want to go see what I knew I was going to see. And I picked a young guy up, I sponsor. I said, come on, we got to go to the old man's house. And I was crying. He said, Butch, what's wrong? I said, the old man's gone. He said, how do you know that? I said, because it's June the 10th and the journal's empty. And we got there and we got to the condo and they let us in the condo and there was that little man. He was kneeling beside his bed, face down, and he was gone. And it was like somebody unzipped me and took out my heart. There was a loneliness inside. There was an emptiness inside like I hadn't felt in a long time. And I was there and the coroner come and all those people and it got late and they all finished and they said, it's okay, kid, you can go home now. And I drove out to the lake where Howard was at my home on the lake and I sat down Howard at that lake and I had a long cry. Friends, that's not a sad story. I had 15 years with one of the finest members Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever known. Tom Ivester once said my sponsor was the most gentleman he'd ever met. Huh? But there was a part of my life had just ended and would never be the same again. And I missed them. I missed them. But I got up from there and I went upstairs. And before I got in bed, I knelt down beside my bed and I thanked God for another day of sobriety. You see, my friends, Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon work in the good times and they work in the tough times. Alcoholics Anonymous works all the time. In those darkest hours when you think your heart is going to break in two and you can't make it another day, that's when the men and women in your home group and a power that you've been introduced to will pick you up and carry you home every single time. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity of being here this weekend. I'm so looking forward to hearing and being with my friends. You know, I don't know what's going to happen from here on in, and none of us know for sure, do we? You see, just because we get sober, become members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, life doesn't stop happening. People die. Relationships end. Businesses fail. People get sick. Life goes on. But I'll tell you something. Every single day, including this morning, I say to my friend upstairs first thing in the morning, I say, if you see fit, I sure would appreciate it if you keep me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because my dear friends, there's no place in this whole world I'd rather be than right here with you fine, fine people. Thank you and God bless.